town being open.
Excellent.
Nice to work in town, actually. Yes. I always have lived here. I was doing the commute. Yeah, it's great. I don't know what to do with all this time. There's really no excuse not to go to the gym at this point.
Sure. Okay. Let's go ahead and get started. The microphone system's out, right? We're not getting any mic. So everyone's going to need to speak up tonight. We do have the recorder up here, but the mic system's not working. It is 6:09. Calling this, I call this meeting to order.
Bennett?
Here.
Branham?
Here.
Driscoll?
Here.
Ferguson?
Here.
Kilgore? Rappaport?
Here.
Rollinsgate?
Here.
Sullivan?
Here.
Richards?
Here. Is there a motion to approve this agenda?
So moved.
Moved by Sullivan. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Ferguson. Is there any discussion on that? All in favor of approving the agenda, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All against, please say aye. Approval of agenda passes. We right now have two public participation slips. If you want to speak to the task force, it's not too late to fill out a slip in the corner and bring it up. First up, we have Patsy Petrie.
I just have two things. First of all, I want to thank the two members of the task force who were able to come on the 26th of June and hear the presentations from the four firms. And the second is for you, those of you who have scheduled conflicts and could not come and join us on the 26th, Channel 5 is showing that meeting at 7 p.m., Channel 5, 7 p.m. on the 7th of July, and I will forewarn you that it's a 4-hour and 23-minute meeting, so if you have a project like cleaning your kitchen and your TV's in the kitchen, it's a great way to watch the presentations and get some work done at the same time. Thank you very much.
Okay, next up we have Chris Evans.
I'm Chris Evans, District 8, and at this time I thought maybe it would be important if we had some context and some perspective and some sense of scale regarding alternatives to incarceration in Champaign County. For instance, drug court. When Champaign County attempts to boast of having a drug court since 1999, and that 174 people have successfully graduated from the program since 1999, we need to measure that success against the number of drug prosecutions and arrests since 1999. For instance, the Illinois State Police calculates that between 1999 and 2009, Champaign County made 12,297 drug arrests, and that's an average of about 1,117 drug arrests a year. Between the years 1999 and 2009, Champaign County sent 1,777 new people to the Department of Corrections on drug convictions. That's an average of 177 new people sent a year to the Department of Corrections for drugs. The Division of Alcohol and Substance Abuse notes that Champaign County had a high of 1,468 illicit drug treatment admissions in 2006, but in 2009, our drug treatment admissions dropped to 622. When we say we have felony diversion now, since this June, we need to understand that The state's attorney speculates that only 200 cases a year will qualify for this new program. It serves well to compare the number 200 against how many felonies Champaign County files. From 1999 to 2010, the Administrative Office of the Illinois Courts compiled that Champaign County filed 27,146 felonies for an average of 2,262 felonies a year. In 2010, Champaign County ranked 8th out of 109 counties in most number of felonies filed. Our rate of felonies per 100,000 is 18th out of 109 counties in 2010. And between 1999 and 2009, Champaign County sent 6,044 new court admissions to the Department of Corrections. That's an average of 549 people a year. Since its inception in 2010, Mental Health Court, it's rumored to have only 5 cases referred to it. If you were to say that Champaign County has alternatives to incarceration, you would have to qualify such a statement with the word hardly. In 2009, the Crime Reduction Act was passed, and I'm still learning about this act, and I hope that we maybe can talk about it by anyone that does know about the Crime Reduction Act, but it's something about redeploying eligible offenders for a program that rewards counties and jurisdictions with financial incentives to find alternatives. It's estimated that in 2008, Champaign County had 401 individuals that were eligible for this program. In 2009, 331, and 2010, 317 people that went to the Department of Corrections that could have been found eligible for alternatives to incarceration. So I'm hoping that this group, and I know it's dedicated to do so, in asking the right questions, the hard questions, as to how we can expand alternatives to incarceration. What's the holdup? Only 174 have made it through our drug court in 13 years. We need to really get going on how we can better use our public dollar to more effectively reduce the incidence of crime. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Chris. Is there any further public participation?
Mr. Chairman, can I ask that be entered into the record, and can we have access to those facts and figures so that we can independently check them and also that we can refer to them as we prepare our
Chris, do you have anything you'd like to give us?
I can give you that. I mean, it's just
to
off
give the group.
Yeah, the website, the numbers that I've cited off, you're welcome to have those.
Yeah, that would be very helpful, having both citations. Thank you so much.
Okay, sir. Next up, we have the minutes from the last meeting, June 4th. Somebody like to?
I have two quick corrections.
Are you moving approval?
Subject to some corrections, yes.
Would somebody like to move approval?
I'll move
second
approval.
That. Rappaport moves approval. Anybody? We need a motion before Driscoll second it. Okay, Scott.
On line 186, under the State's Attorney Adult Diversion Program, I would just note that it's not, I wasn't speaking about the Adult Diversion Program, which already existed. I was speaking about the new program called the Second Chance Program. And the difference, and maybe I misspoke last time, isn't so much that it's geared toward adults or people 18 years or older, but that it's geared toward felony offenses, not misdemeanor offenses, as the prior Adult Diversion Program focused on. So just to clarify that, there may be some confusion in reading this. The Adult Diversion Program itself isn't particularly changing as much as there's a new program which addresses felony charges.
Are you talking about line 189?
186.
Okay.
Well, I mean, just it's under the heading and under 184 of Adult Diversion Program, but it should be Second Chance Program.
Okay. And tell us what you want it to be changed to.
I suppose it should read, 184 should read, State's Attorney's Second Chance Program.
Okay.
And then and Ms. Reese is here. She can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I don't believe you have to be 18 years or older to be the second chance, or do you?
Well, it would be 17.
So I suppose it should be 17 or older under 187, on 187. And I think otherwise it's correct.
Okay, so I will take that as a motion to amend the minutes. Is there a second on that?
Second.
Okay. All in favor of amending the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All in favor against, motion to amend passes. Are there any other corrections to the minutes?
Can I, just looking at the discussion about the state's attorney's program, it appears there was a question that Ms. Rollins-Gay had about juveniles. Juveniles are handled through Station Adjustment Program, which is run by the Regional Planning Commission. And so there's a juvenile diversion program that's available to them, somewhat similar to an adult program.
My question was, some of those kids never committed anything and the charges dropped, but then some of those kids went to college and that information was on their record. They didn't have to do diversion programs. So my question was, how do you handle that? Because I was concerned with the minority kids not being able to obtain jobs because it was the information was dismissed. But because they got fingerprinted when they went, that information then, when this child finished college, was on their record. And when they found out, they were like, wow, because this is a straight-A student.
Well, if it's a juvenile, then that shouldn't be accessible to employers. But if they were not charged and not convicted, then what they can do is they can apply for an expungement of their record.
Which costs the family money.
And it doesn't cost anything to file for an expungement with the circuit clerk's office. And the circuit clerk's office has paperwork, and they can file for an expungement. And basically what that does is it deletes their entire record. All records have to be destroyed. It simply doesn't exist anymore if they were not charged or were not convicted.
But my thing, Julie, and this was maybe my question, when those things happen, why isn't that process done with the court? If that's out, why would that still remain? Why would that, when they turn 21 or 22, they have to go back through that? So I think, I'm just wondering about the process so you clarified it, because I never knew that. I never knew that information. A couple of parents addressed me about it, and I was like, wow, this is something new, so that's why I brought it up. I know you have the PL, we have a lot of diversion programs, and the kids turn out very well because of all these programs.
Right, and that's the goal, to get them in early and get them moving forward so that we don't see
And so
them.
Now I can educate them on what you just told me.
Yeah, and we can probably work on the education of that process as well.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Do we have any other changes to the minutes? Okay. All in favor of the minutes as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say aye. Minutes pass. Tonight's main feature, we have a presentation from McLean County on their pretrial services program. So, hope you guys have big voices. We can't wait to hear about it.
Good evening, everybody. I think the last time I did a really bad presentation, I didn't have anywhere to hide, but thankfully we have this wall, so have something to work with there. But, thank you all for having me here tonight. My name is Sargeel Rizvi. I go by Sarge. It's the best way to remember my name. I am the pretrial services coordinator here in McLean County. I was hired on in 2007. There was a pretrial team that was formulated by way of collaboration by some key stakeholders within our system. That included our chief judge, our criminal judge division, state's attorney, chief public defender, jail staff, and several other key stakeholders. They put together a team, and they felt it was necessary to address what was the main issue that was standing before them, which was dealing with the jail overcrowding in McLean County. During that period of time, there was an average of about, the jail was at full capacity, and there was about 30 to 35 individuals, in addition to the overcapacity, that were being housed out of county at rates of anywhere between $50 to $100 a day at the county's expense. Additionally, this didn't even take into account costs that were being incurred for transport. becoming an overbearing situation, and it led to the formulation of a major question, and that is, are we putting the right individuals in there? Does everybody need to be in there? The vast majority of individuals were pretrial detainees. It could be argued that a number of them were there for nonviolent offenses. So the question is, are we putting people that we're afraid of, or are we putting people in there that we're mad at? So with that came my hiring. I basically came from Kankakee County. I had worked there 10 years, 5 as a juvenile officer, and then another 5 as a pretrial officer. And I thought this was a great opportunity for me to basically take on this challenge of seeing if I could put together a program similar to my background, and then see where it goes from there. So I'm happy to report that 5 years later, you know, we've had some great success. Overall, we have about an 85% success rate of individuals that are released out on bond, and they're supervised as an alternative. The success rate comes with the fact that the vast majority of these people will come back to court without failing to appear, and they will do that without picking up any new offenses, and a good number of them will follow special conditions of bail, primarily drug treatment, mental health treatment. But a little bit about what I do. You know, pretrial services basically is a program that provides the court with verified criminal history and social history about individuals that have been arrested and charged with an offense. We assist the court in providing as much information as possible about an individual before they are released out on bond. You know, the traditional method has always been the guy gets arrested, state files charges, there's a probable cause statement that's read at the initial custody hearing, and then some information about their criminal history and maybe perhaps their failure to appear history, and a bond is set. And then from there on, there's really nothing else addressed about that bond until a defense attorney that gets assigned later on will request a hearing on their bond. What we try to do is we try to shortcut that whole system altogether. Rather than waiting what used to be 4 weeks to 6 weeks until a defendant's bond is heard, we can now try to get that case up within 1 week back in front of that judge, not only with the information they already know, but a good totality of information about their background, how long an individual has lived in the area, whether they have family ties in the community, whether they have employment or employment prospects. Are they enrolled in school? Do they have a drug issue, mental health problem? So all these issues now also come to surface at the bond hearing, and it provides the judge a fully detailed amount of information to then determine whether this would be a good candidate for release or not. So that's one major function of our program, and then the other one is, of course, providing supervision to those individuals that are released to ensure that they do get provided services, they do show up for court, they don't get rearrested. It's a concept that works very well in our county. Like I said, we have had an 85% success rate in ensuring that this does in fact happen. The whole philosophy behind our program is very simple. We assist individuals that cannot afford bail in getting released. We have the assertion that individuals should not be incarcerated on the sole basis that they don't have enough money to post bond. The only pretrial defendants that belong in jail are those that pose a risk of flight or a physical danger to the community, or even arguably a physical danger to themselves. The only pretrial inmates that belong in jail are those that no conditions of release can assure the possibility that they're going to return for court hearings or assure public safety. We ensure that a defendant will return to court without committing new offenses, provide them with appropriate services, and a key thing that we utilize is the concept of evidence-based practices. And I'll go into that a little bit more in detail. But again, this to me has, you know, again, this turned into a jail overcrowding program, a jail alternative program. Well, essentially, we still deal with jail overcrowding, not nearly to the capacity that we were back in 2007. So it's not to assume then that, well, jail overcrowding has been solved, you know, you can go ahead and leave now. You know, I think something else is good that's come out of this. There are other benefits to having a pretrial program, and as I was stressing earlier, I think judges are appreciative of the fact that they don't have to just make bond decisions on little or no information. They are getting fully detailed background information about an individual now before they make that decision. In fact, there are at least two judges in our criminal court that don't even want to conduct a bond hearing without one of our reports now. And I think that speaks volumes as to where, you know, how far we've come. The court benefits based on the background. The state's attorney's office benefits as well, because sometimes when they're busy and they have a high volume of cases they're working with in that initial screening phase, sometimes our assistance in providing some criminal history information that they may have overlooked is now present in that report. You know, certain classification of a prior offense. Of course, our public defenders, they're huge allies of ours, of course. You know, we're assisting them with expediting their bond motions. But sometimes even a bond report that we prepare, although it may not recommend someone's release, it will assist in helping the case move faster as well. Because now the defense attorney has access to all that criminal history information they may not have had in the earlier stages when they first got the case. And they're now able to work a deal along with the state and maybe moving the case faster, resolving it to some type of disposition. Everybody pretty much benefits from having a pretrial program. A probation office within itself benefits.
Sorry, should we ask questions as you go, or should we wait until you're done? Because you've got a bunch of bullet points here in your very thoughtfully prepared presentation, but some of it's a little... I just have some questions about some of these things.
Sure.
How would you like to handle that, or Mr. Chairman, how would you like to handle it?
If it's helpful to the task force, I don't see any reason not to ask questions as we go.
Yeah, that's fine by me.
Do you have any questions?
Yeah, one question. So how... I like the statement, the only pretrial defendants that belong in jail are those who pose a risk of flight or present a physical danger to the community. And I'm thinking, oh, that sounds really good, but I'm guessing there's no litmus test. You can't just ask a person, do you have a risk of flight? Or do you pose a... Julian, you look like you could be a threat. How do you decide that? What tool or evidence do you use?
Okay. Yeah, I can answer that. Our reports are also... what's included in our reports is a... basically a validated risk assessment scale. It was approved by the Illinois Supreme Court, and it was also approved by the Bar Association, and as well as our National Pretrial Services Association, Pretrial Justice Institute, and National Institute of Corrections. Now, our risk assessment scale, I will say, is a little bit dated. We are in the process of trying to get trained on a more newer and evidence-based scale, but we utilize the scale as a way of determining what levels of risk an individual poses. What are their mitigating risk factors and what are their aggravating risk factors? And in most cases, if the mitigating factors outweigh those that are aggravating, those are individuals who we feel are going to be successful candidates that were released. And of course, vice versa. If aggravated outweighs the mitigating. There are instances, though, and no matter what the case is, and no matter what this risk level is, we are still an entity of court services. So, you know, we're not going to ignore public safety. That's going to come first and foremost. And I want to make something also very clear, and I hope this answers anybody else's question. This program is not out there to basically walk into a jail and open the door and say, everybody out. You know, that's definitely not the case at all. In fact, close to 60% of the cases we screen every year are recommended for non-release. So, you know, but we do feel strongly that there is a percentage of population in that jail that, quite frankly, does not need to be there. And instead of keeping them there, can provide that alternative, and that alternative seems to work.
Well, thank you. That's an incredibly helpful answer, and it's nice to know that you're using these tools and that you're searching for evidence-based tools in the future. That's something that we should...
I want to add something, too. I'm sorry, Mr. Supervisor. I'm Chris Bailey. They also do research whether or not the people that they're considering for release have failed to appear in court before, and that's a big piece of the puzzle because that's the number one thing that we're worried about. If we let them out, will we see them back? And, of course, that... coupled with the research of what their prior offenses are, if there are, you know, assaultive offenses, then we may have a public safety issue, and so we want to err on the side of caution with those types of folks.
And just one more thing I want to point out. The statement that was made about the only individuals as far as being a risk of flight or a public, though that statement right there is actually consistent with the main bail statute, you know, the purpose of bail, the purpose of bond. So our philosophy has to coincide exactly with that, because that's the main thing that we deal with is bond. Is bond. So, any other questions?
Feel free to answer this later, or maybe you already have it in these materials, mm-hmm. but at some point, could you comment on the numbers of people that you handle, how many staff it takes, mm-hmm. what their training is like, and approximately what the cost is to the county to do that?
Sure.
Because those are just practical sorts of questions that will come up.
Yeah, absolutely.
It may have already been in here, so feel free to wait until...
Yeah, there's definitely stuff there, but like I said, I'm actually here more for you guys than I am here to do a whole, you know, spiel about the program. So I'm more than happy to answer questions, and if that's comprised of most of this, I'm happy with that as well. But starting from the beginning, right now our office is staffed with two officers. That's myself, and I have a partner, and basically we've divided the workload in where she basically will do most of the screenings of cases that are ordered by the court and prepare them for, you know, the following week when they go back up in front of the judge. I do a majority of the supervision of the cases. Now we also divide, because we're an evidence-based program, we also divide our supervision caseload in accordance to their level of risk. So because she's doing most of the screenings, she's going to handle more of the lower level, lower risk individuals. Whereas myself, I'm taking on a bigger supervision caseload, so I'm going to see the higher risk individuals. Higher risk people have to report more frequently. They're engaged in services, whereas the lower risk individuals, they have to come in a little less frequently. What does it do as far as costs? My statistics will basically show, particularly last year. What I did is I prepared a stat, which is kind of a cost-benefit analysis of having a pretrial program. And the number that strikes out, and the way I did this is very simple. In our jail, on average, it costs $45 a night for a bed stay. That's an average. What I did was, we had 131 people that we supervised last year. And an average individual spent about 99 to about 100 days under our supervision until their case was disposed of or until the judge felt they didn't need to be under our supervision. When you multiply the number of days that each individual was supervised by 45, that figure came out to $694,170 that the county could potentially have saved. If there were no pretrial program and those individuals had to remain in jail for that entire time. Now, there is definitely plus or minus. You could look at a plus or minus ratio in that. You can argue that if they were in jail, their cases may have moved faster, and so maybe they would have spent less time in jail than they did with us. But on the flip side, you can also argue that some of these inmates could have been housed out of county at a rate of $80 to $100 a day. So that would have added to that cost as well. But this is basically how I prepared that cost-benefit analysis. And again, I think our county board is, you know, they were very happy to see that.
Do you use electronic home monitoring and alcohol bracelet monitoring? Part of your program when someone's on pretrial release?
Yes.
Who pays for that?
That basically, that is an offender-based pay program. Right now, obviously, and it's across the state, you know, counties are going through a crunch and everything like that, so we don't have the ability, we don't have the ability to pay for individuals. The technology is not cheap either. It is rather expensive. But we do use it. We try to use it sparingly, but we do have to use it on certain cases where violation order protections are involved. There's laws with, that run consistent with the use of GPS as a condition, and we do use it on some what would be considered some very high risk level cases, certain burglaries, sexual assaults, cases where the need to provide surveillance on a more frequent basis than any ordinary individual. So we do try. We do try to use that.
Can you? I'm sorry. Can you? You had said before something about bond motions that it taking 4 to 6 weeks before bond is set. Can you maybe walk us through the process in McLean County, because I think their process is different from ours.
Certainly, as it was from the county that I also came from. What I had learned when I first came to McLean County, I didn't start operations of this program until about 3 or 4 months after I, you know, moved down here, because I wanted to learn, you know, exactly how the court system works. So basically, an individual got arrested. They go in front of a custody judge. At that stage, there's no assigned public defender. They get their bond. The case gets continued for an arraignment. That comes up about a week or 2 weeks later. At the arraignment stage, there's a public defender present, but it's still not their actual assigned public defender. It's a public defender that's standing in for the purpose of doing the arraignment. Then that case is continued out about another 3 to 4 weeks for an initial status date. At that stage, either a public defender, again, I'm talking about that time period as well, but at that stage, the public defender would either meet the individual for the first time, or they would do so with a bond motion. So you're basically talking about a 4 to 6 week period before the issue of bond was heard. Now, we have made some significant improvements. When I say we, I'm not talking about just pretrial alone, but our court system in general. We have a criminal justice coordinating council that's made up of the very same stakeholders I was mentioning earlier. And we have, you know, together, collectively devised some better strategies and ways of trying to reduce the number of jail days that individuals are being housed. And moving the court system, the cases, a little bit faster is one of those ways. So some of that time period has shortened, but initially that is what we were dealing with when I first got down here. So 4 to 6 weeks was just entirely way too long a time for someone's bond to be addressed, especially if they were a case that could have easily been left a lot sooner.
Sarge, one of the things I was most impressed with when I went to your office first time was that board on your wall, and the idea that it's not a one-size-fits-all, it's not one supervision for all.
Right.
There's different levels for your different people. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the different levels and how someone with that was a high risk might have, what would they would expect as opposed to someone who would not be a high risk?
Yeah, I mean, this is all of this stuff was created through a lot of research that we had to do. Now, I know there are the National Association Pretrial Services Agencies, NASA, created what's called a Standards of Pretrial Release. You can actually find that publication in NASA.org. But basically, one of the things that they had recommended is that you have to utilize evidence-based practices. And when you do that, you have to provide what's called the least restrictive means of supervision on every individual. You have to manage each individual in accordance to their risk. So if you've got a person who's a nonviolent offender, they have no history of violence, they have very little to no history of failing to appear in court, you know, they may have a drug issue, that is not someone that you basically corral and smother like 2-3 times a week. You know, this is an individual that if you do that, they are more likely to feel like they're being treated like a criminal, and therefore could end up with that self-fulfilling prophecy. They're more likely to fail. So those are individuals, again, you have to categorize. It's like a triage, you know, in the medical field. You know, you have the lowest risk individuals, who, by the way, they also use evidence-based practices. But you have your lowest risk individuals on one side. You have your higher risk on another side. And then, of course, we had our electronically monitored individuals in another category. But that seems to work for us. And again, it presents great results for us. So going back to your question, sir, was there something in addition you had with regards to our staffing?
Just go ahead and carry on. I think it would be better if you...
Okay. Yeah, basically, again, everybody does benefit. Our own department benefits in that an individual who we had that we were supervising, if they one day end up getting on probation, well, now the probation officer doesn't have to go at great lengths of finding out as much information they need about this person because they already got it from us. We are also, what basically becomes drug court or mental health court, they started with us. A good number of them, we were told by our recovery mental health court that we were their highest referral source. And we are able to provide the ins and outs about the individual, even to the point where, you know, whether they would be a good candidate in those programs. So a lot of our successful drug court and mental health court cases started with us. But in general, the public benefits, in a way. Inmates that were employed prior to getting arrested and are able to return to work, guess what? They're still back and paying taxes, whereas if they're, you know, they're housed in jail, it's the other way around. We're still paying for them. They lose work, they're unemployed, they're drawn on unemployment, or other social services. So there's a benefit all around, everywhere, to having pre-trial services.
Sorry, can I ask you about, you had said that you operate as a referral source for your court or mental health court.
Mm-hmm.
In the jail in McLean County, do they have mental health professionals? What can you describe for us?
Yeah, they do have, well, I don't know exactly if that's something, a resource that's cut or not. You know, they've been kind of going back and forth. But they do assessments, mental health. They have a medical staff in our jail as well. So there are those initial identifiers there. But, of course, a lot of these individuals, rather than continuing to house them in jail, they're provided that alternative to pretrial release with us. And a condition of their bond can be consistent with take your medication, go to the local mental health agency, counselor. And if they seem to be stable and they're complying with that, that tells us a good idea that, you know what, they might do really, really well if they get to that recovery court stage where, you know, again, these programs are very effective in their way as well because they're doing that daily monitoring and accountability aspect similar to drug court.
Can I just kind of answer that? At least when I was there a month ago, Mark Benson was still the clinician of McLean County Jail. I was actually considering asking him to come speak, but then I realized Champaign actually had a better comprehensive system than we did over there. But I think the difference is, while he is almost like a triage system as they come in, he's a clinician trying to identify issues and possible disorders. You guys are able to kind of get into their background and actually see if they're eligible based on the other parameters of the program. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we do consult with all of them as well. Try to see if there has been any kind of, you know, assistance provided at that stage. Because again, we're not mental health professionals, obviously. We don't have the basis to tell whether somebody is fit or not fit to stand trial, what their diagnosis is. But in working with them, we do learn, you know, a clear difference between an individual who's not taking their medication and that they are. And again, if they seem to be responding well to our level of services, then it can be argued that they'll do really well on the next stage if they're accepted in the recovery board. So that seems to work pretty well. The other point I want to make is a lot of individuals, a lot of people see pre-trial services as some new fascinating program. But the fact is, this has been around for well over 50 years. It's still not utilized, you know, in great numbers of counties. but I do happen to sit as a co-chair representing the Illinois Probation Court Services Association, IPCSA. I am a co-chair in our pretrial services committee, and some of the people that are in my committee have been pretrial officers in their counties for 25, 30 years. So a lot of what I've learned from them, and you know, our job is always to try to educate, you know, individuals all over the state, promote the idea that, you know, this concept does work. We, you know, we're never going to tell anybody whether they should or shouldn't start a program, but we will always tell people why we do and why it works for us. So,
anybody else? People are arrested and go to trial in McLean County per year.
Well, that's a good question. Those are numbers that I don't have before me. What I can tell you is that we had about 376 reports that were ordered by the court or referred to us to screen. We submitted about 305 reports. Somewhere in the middle, the difference of that number are individuals that were able to post bond before we even saw them. But we did complete about 305 reports. And again, about 42% of the individuals in that number were people that we had recommended release on. So, the number of felony cases that are filed, I mean, it has to go up somewhere in the thousands, probably, I'd say.
So you've got around a third or less than a third, more like a quarter of the people that are arrested and go to trial.
That's true.
Are actually come through your system.
Right.
And of that quarter, about 40 or 45% get recommended for.
Right.
And the other, of the 700 people who you don't see per year, you not see them because their bail is so low they just get bail right away, or what's going on with those folks?
Yeah, absolutely. A good number of those people were given a bail at the very beginning that they were able to post. You know, some of these, you know, they could, a lot of these could be your low-level felony cases where the bond was low at the very initial setting, and they were able to post. I mean, even
so, you're seeing the more, you're seeing the higher. People are going to have more difficulty posting bail are the folks that come to you. Is that correct?
Yeah, but that, and that's not to say, though, some of these individuals are low-level felonies that don't have even $100 to their name. You know, so there's a good number of those. The vast majority of my cases are not your higher level. You know, we still have to consider public safety. So we're not going to outwardly just come out and say, hey, can we please screen this homicide guy, you know, or this guy, this home invasion, you know. We will still do it if the court orders us to do it, but, you know, our position is such that we still have to consider public safety, so we're not just going to outwardly come out and, you know, and take on some of those kind of cases. We also have to consider our resources. Our staff is just two of us. So during the summer, which is where your highest crime, you know, levels are, there's only so much we're going to be able to take on as well. So we have to consider what our resources are able to do as well.
Speaking of that, how many cases can you manage, the two of you?
Yeah, I mean, standard, really, it starts to get kind of difficult when you approach the 40 mark, really.
40 so. Between the two of you?
Yeah, in between the two of us. Now, that's not to say that we haven't been able to do 50 or 60. That's happened. But that's where it's very important, where, again, you kind of go into that evidence-based little triage mode I was talking about. If we haven't, not every individual that we supervise through the entirety of their case until disposition. We might have a person who showed up for all three of the court dates. They completed their treatment successfully. They've given us clean drug screens, but their case is still pending. But you know what? There comes a time where you feel pretty confident. I think this guy's going to show up at the future court dates. I think he's going to do it without getting in further trouble. So we will make a recommendation with the court requesting their discharge from us. And that allows for that cycle, that flow of taking cases out while taking new cases in. So, but it does get up there. I know the holidays can get pretty busy, and right around this time of the year can get pretty busy. So,
I thought I picked up earlier you had about 130 cases you managed over the course of a year.
Yes. Yes.
And that's just you and the other?
Yes.
So what would you say your average length of, I guess, engagement with the?
The average individual spent about 100 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't get enough pictures.
Yeah. So.
I just want to confirm something I thought I heard. Is the screening only on court order?
No. We also take cases that are referred by their public defender or private attorney. Sometimes an individual gets a bond, and the court may choose not to order one at that stage. So at a later stage, the defense attorney or the assigned public defender will file a motion to reduce bond, and with that, send us a referral asking us to prepare a report on that.
And you'll go ahead and do that without the court ordering?
Right.
Here would be my question, though, mm-hmm. because I know there's different models for pretrial services. Mm-hmm. It sounds like the initiator is either the judge or the public defender. And my question is, does that work for you because of resource constraints? In an ideal system, would you be looking at the reports and going to the judge and saying, this is a good one for pretrial services?
Actually, that is a function that we also practice. In fact, every day when we have, every day with about an hour before custody, take a look and see the number of felony custodies that are going before the judge that day. We call it a preliminary record check. Basically, we'll go in and take a look at each individual, and we don't have time to do a full-on criminal history, but we'll just start with the basic. We'll do with the local. And if the local is basically showing us 10 prior felony convictions coupled with about 25 prior failures to appear, probably not going to be someone getting on our list, you know. But if you see someone in there with a nonviolent felony offense, looks fairly new to the system, doesn't have 103 mugshot images, you know, that's someone that we might throw on the list as saying, hey, the judge ultimately makes a decision. However, if you do decide and this guy can't post bond, go ahead and feel free to order that if you'd like. So that's basically how that works.
So you recommend that the judge order a screening?
To an extent. Because the judge doesn't have to, and we even put that disclaimer in our forms that the court has the authority to go with this or not go with this, or even order someone that we didn't put on our list. It's ultimately the court's decision. But again, if you're going to do it, these appear to be, just based on record alone, initially, these look like they'd be decent candidates. So,
can I ask one more question bearing on that? How often do the judges follow your recommendation to go to the next step of screening?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the very beginning, not very much. But again, that was because of the process of it and, you know, the fear of the unknown, per se. But gradually, when you see these numbers and you see that, oh, we're making it happen, you know, That guy that's accused of drug dealing that later on gets convicted of possession, we took a chance, we let him out, and he did everything he was supposed to do, and he showed up every court date. The confidence started growing, and when it did, they started going with that a little bit more. So
we also get referrals from the jail itself. We have the inmate services representatives, and we just start to call and say, hey,
yeah.
I'm a little bit confused about the time involved. Mm-hmm. So, sort of, how long does it take to set someone's screen?
Well, basically, I'll answer that in basically two parts. When I first started this program, I wanted it to be where we had a report on every single individual the day of, you know, the day they got arrested, the very next day they're before a judge. I want to have a report ready that day. Because there are counties that do that. But those are counties that have higher staff, higher number of staff. You have to do it in accordance to how your court system works, coupled with what you have. And so we have a two-person unit, and the way our court system is designed, we don't know if a person is going to get accused of a crime or if the state's going to file charges on them until about an hour to an hour and a half before the custody hearing. So when I tried doing that method, I realized that I was spending a lot of time doing reports on cases that either got dismissed, the charges got reduced to a misdemeanor, and they got that personal recognizance anyway. So a lot of time was being exhausted on that. So what we felt would work better is to have the bond set. If they can't post the bond, the court ordered a report, and then we get it up within about 5 working days. So we have the time to thoroughly do our investigation, because it does require a full-on, you know, criminal history inquiry. And sometimes, if you got an individual who may have something out of state or in another jurisdiction that requires a little more, you know, research, you're going to need that time. So
just to give context, the thing we passed around, since we have one copy of it, that's the report. That's an example of a report that you would get for the judge.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's what we would put together. No interview takes place because they are in the pretrial phase. No interview takes place without them understanding what their rights are, that they do have a right to refuse it, that they don't have to participate, that they can't have an attorney present during the interview. And once that happens, then we go through the interview process. We then do the criminal history inquiries. We put all that, you know, put all their prior conviction information in there, including juvenile. We don't go by just self-reports. We don't go by what they tell us. We have them provide us collateral contact information, so we're able to right away contact those individuals and verify what they are saying. If that's where they're saying they live and that's how long, well, we want to be able to call someone that can tell us that information. We try to do that right away, you know, before that one phone call that they get, you know. But we want to do that right away and make sure that the information is accurate and can be verified. We take all that and then we plug that into our risk assessment scale. We come up with a score, and we make our recommendation. So
from the point at which you take a referral,
mm-hmm.
how long does it take you typically?
It depends on the case.
I mean, I realize there'll be variation, but...
Yeah, it depends on the case. I mean, I've had cases where... We had the time and resources and ability to get the report done within the next day. And in those cases, you know, we'll send an email out to the prosecutor's office. Hey, I know this case is set for bond review in like 5 days, but the report's done. I'm recommending the release. Take a look at it. Tell me what you think. And if everybody's in agreement, why don't we get this guy up in front of the judge tomorrow? So that has happened. It doesn't happen often, because again, we're not just talking about one report. We could be talking about a total of about 15 that are ordered in 1 week. So we're trying to meet those deadlines. So we're gonna, more often than not, we're gonna need those 5 working days. So, yeah. Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned, or maybe one of the two you did, inmate service representatives. How do they work, and do they make referrals to you?
Yeah, I mean, they work.
Who are they, I guess?
Yeah, who are they? Well, they are everything that I'm not, that's for sure. They're a very, very integral part of the jail process. They're basically there they perform an intake when a person comes in the beginning, and they put their background information, you know, for the jail. They make services to medical staff. They answer and deal with a lot of requests that inmates may have. They work solely, you know, for and with the inmate to address whatever needs that they have while they're in the jail. And again, often they are the first line right there of knowing anything and everything about an individual's background that's in there. So if you got a person that's been in there a while and, you know, they have that feeling that this might be a good candidate, you know, they might give me a call and say, hey, what do you think about taking a look at this guy and see, you know, and of course I had to tell them, well, let's see what their attorneys think. And yeah, sure enough, we'll get this up in front of the judge. But they have a very multifaceted role. I mean, they address a lot of different needs, you know, beyond just bond.
So who do they work for? How are they funded?
They work for the jail superintendent, aka the warden, but as well as the sheriff. So they have their own offices inside the jail. You know, like they're kind of part of the jail administration. So.
They kind of figure out where the inmates are going to be housed based upon their needs and their affiliations and different things like that, and what services they're going to require so that
they're also a big part of my success comes from them as well, because, you know, it's like they're giving me the head start in that race, you know what I mean? So.
Several questions. First, can you give me a picture of the organizational chart? In other words, are the two of you over here? Are you part of a larger group, court services, or can you give us a little bit for that, please?
Certainly. Well, I don't know if I'm part of any hierarchy, you know, but, you know, we definitely, I work in the Division of Court Services. I work along with line officers who basically deal with convicted probationers. I'm very thankful to actually work in a department that has so many specialty, you know, positions. You know, we have probation officers that deal solely with domestic violence. We have probation officers that deal solely with sex offenders. We have a mental health court officer, two of them, two drug court officers, so it's two pretrial officers. And we also have what's called the ARI officer.
You want an org chart type of deal?
Well, I'm again trying to figure out who they...
Okay, so in adult probation, adult court services, we have the director on the top there. There are two deputy directors, myself and my partner. Under the deputy directors are what's called P2s, probation officer 2, which are supervisory status, which is basically our program coordinators. Sarge is one of those. And then his partner is a regular line staff officer. So he's a supervisor, but he's got the one person who's responsible for the pretrial, but I'm over pretrial.
And the funding for just the pretrial services county comes from solely county.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, when this program first started, it started with the belief that only I was going to do it, all of it. But that was at the time when it wasn't known that there was a whole secondary function of this program, which was the supervision component. They thought I was just going to go down to jail and screen people. But it had to, you know, I had to make the argument, well, I can screen these people, but who's going to get them back to court, you know, or who's going to make sure they're going to do their drug treatment or, you know, or try to stay clean and, again, show up for court. So there has to be some kind of function there that assures that this is successful, that we're not just letting anybody out. So when they learned of that, they felt that there wasn't a very critical one of having a second officer.
There are some counties that only screen. They do not have enough staff to supervise them, so they just decide whether or not that person is going to use or not.
Right.
Just on the funding issue, you had said it's funded by the county. Are they considered probation officers so that there's reimbursement from the state for their salaries?
Yes, the state reimburses, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's, so it's not totally separate.
Right.
And did you have
but
to
the
get...
The state gives us zero, the county pays.
Did you have to do anything special with the state in order to qualify?
That would be a better question for your director of court services, because I don't know the AOIP stuff. I think Sarge's position is supposed to be 100%.
Do you know what other counties in Illinois use pretrial services?
Oh, there's, well, we conducted a survey and sent it out to every county a while back. I want to say about 4 or 5 years ago. And we learned that there were at least 35 that had responded back. We learned also that there's a number of counties in the state of Illinois that don't have pretrial services per se, but they do perform pretrial functions where they have, you know, their set of line officers where, you know, a judge releases somebody out on bond and orders some conditions and then orders an officer from the probation department to check on them and make sure they show up in court. But I do know that it is growing. In fact, there is at least another county I know that has expressed interest in wanting to develop a program. There's a couple of them. But it is growing. And the reason why it's growing is because of certain aspects such as the Cindy Bischoff law, which was the violation order of protection law, in which many cases where an individual is released on bond, they would be subject to GPS monitoring. Well, somebody has to make sure they're complying with that, and the people that typically make sure that's happening is pretrial services. Now, other departments may do it differently, and if that's what works for them, that's fine, you know. But there are counties that are growing with pretrial services on that basis. I believe there is some pending legislation involved with regards to PR bonds being, I don't know if it's mandated, but I know there's something about PR bonds are going to be increasing on nonviolent offenses. And again, you know, who's going to monitor them if they are ordered to some kind of supervision? So, but again, I do sit on this committee, and I know that it seems like every time we have a committee meeting, there's always some talk of another county that's expressing interest in wanting to develop the program. And so how can we step in and help them with that? So
when you got to McLean County, had it pretty much been decided they were already going to do a pretrial program? Were there some stakeholders or areas of the courthouse community that were hesitant to do that?
Mm-hmm. There was some resistance. But there was resistance when I first started in Kankakee County back in 2002 as well. Again, there's going to be resistance because sometimes there's that fear of change. You know, that there's like that whole tradition of, oh man, this is really going to stir the pot up a little bit. So you're gonna have, you know, and maybe again, you know, politics could arguably play a role. But generally speaking, the fear of change, the fear of unknown, oh my God, who are these people that are going to step in here and let these people out of jail and going to go out and kill somebody, you know, or somebody's going to get hurt, or somebody's not going to come back to court. So you're going to get that thrown your way. Believe me, I had to sit through some of these meetings, and there was one or two people that they wanted the facts, they wanted the numbers, they wanted that assurance. You know, and so I used to spend a lot of nights doing a lot of research, just, you know, getting myself fully prepared. But the only thing I'd always come back with it is, give this a shot. Let's see where we're at in a year, or 2 years, or 3 years, and then you guys decide whether you want to continue this or not. So,
Sergeant, I think you had indicated that there was approximately 85% success rate.
Yes.
Of that 85%, how many are sentenced to probation?
A very large number. Yeah.
Do you know what that percentage might be?
I don't off the top of my head. I actually can get that in 2013. I can get that for you. But a significant number of our individuals that are on pretrial supervision, a significant number of them do wind up on probation.
On that 15% that are not successful, there's a small group of those individuals. What happens to those individuals?
Any one of a number of things. They could wind up actually getting probation. Some of them end up going to the Department of Corrections. Actually, a large number of our successful cases are individuals that still wind up going to the Department of Corrections. That is something, because we have no control over certain statutory guidelines. you know, we do get some of those, you know, we don't ask for it all the time, but we do get some of those class X drug offenders that never got in trouble before, that lived there their whole life, and they get let out, and they get put under our supervision, and they do phenomenal. But if they pled to a offense, they pled guilty or found guilty of to an offense that carries a mandatory Department of Corrections sentence, they do have to wind up going. You know, some of them, but I will tell you again, we at no point guarantee any of our clients what the outcome of their case is going to be. We always tell them that's between you and your attorney and, you know, and all that. But what I do say is that statistically, there are a number of individuals that do well with us that at times do wind up with a favorable outcome. If the state was asking at one point in time for 6 years on this individual, well, they did a really phenomenal job. Well, they showed the court that they can function well and do well in the community. So that charge just got reduced by a great number. Or if they were asking for DOC, they would wind up getting probation. Or even for that matter, first offender probation, which then results in a dismissal.
Do you see sometimes that because court services is watching these people so closely that when they do go to get sentenced that they have not doing very well, that their sentence might be enhanced, they might get more time than that they maybe stayed in jail?
For the people where, that were unsuccessful, are you referring to that 15%?
Right.
That tends to happen from time to time. You know, you're going to have some individuals where if they were looking at the possibility of probation and it seems evident that they're not functioning very well in the community in a program that watches over them quite frequently. Yeah, if they can't make it in a situation where they're being seen once or twice a week, how are they going to make it in a situation once or twice a month? So in some of those cases, yeah, that can be a determinant. But it really depends on, it's all on a case-by-case basis. They look at, you know, all different aspects and facets in every case. So.
I think you said you've been doing this for about 5 years?
Well, 10 total
in this camp.
In pretrial services, yeah.
So what I'm curious about is, and you may or may not have data on this, but you probably have some sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hypothesizing that you might see over time an increase in the willingness to allow more people out on their own recognizance, or people who can't afford it to have reduced bail.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are learning what could happen, and so that there may, I'm sure, so what I'm wondering about is if there is an increase in such occurrences,
mm-hmm.
even in the absence of you directly being involved,
mm-hmm.
because you're creating that kind of a
mm-hmm.
attitude and culture in the
mm-hmm.
court system.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense to you, or have you noticed anything like that?
I believe to an extent what you're saying. Again, do PR bonds happen a lot without our intervention? Yeah, absolutely. And they were happening a lot before we got there. They have during, and they will long.
So I'm wondering if you see any more willingness to do it.
Is there an increase in the trend? I wouldn't say so. Again, like I said, I know speaking from our court, you know, we've grown to the point now where if it gets to that position in maybe a higher risk level case, the court wants to know everything about the individual first. And they do that by getting us involved.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking about the people that you would
mm-hmm.
would not be higher risk, but who would be.
Right.
People who are not higher risk
right.
in an ongoing court system
right.
spend a lot of time
right.
because they can't afford the bail, or
sure.
because people are afraid to let them out on their own recognizance.
Yeah.
So you've created a way to screen that.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that just doesn't increase people's sensitivity to it.
Right. No, not necessarily, because I think jail overcrowding itself drives that. You know, there may be a period of time where, again, like maybe this past week or 2 weeks ago, we're getting up there again. And the courts are a bit more likely to grant PR bonds a little more without even us getting involved. You know, especially on those lower level felonies, certainly driving force, but I don't, I haven't seen anything that's out there right now that says our involvement driving it more or less in any way whatsoever. So.
I think this is my last question.
Oh, that's okay.
This is, but we should have given you a chair because
we've
been peppering you with questions.
Yeah,
but one of the concerns that prompted the formation of this task force is a concern about certain people who are mentally ill, who are in the jail, whom it's believed could be, I'm talking right now about the detainee population. And there's been a little bit of discussion, but I want to get into a detail. I visited a program some years ago, pretrial services, where part of that program, the feeling was there were a number of mentally ill detainees. But the only problem, as you mentioned, was their meds. So the program was set up where they showed up each day to get their meds, and then they'd get a stipend for some food or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see, not just with your program, but with your expertise,
yeah,
what kind of models you have seen, because obviously we could think creatively here. We do have places that provide mental
yeah.
health services, but just a little feedback
mm-hmm.
about how you could envision that working with people who are mentally ill,
mm-hmm.
who the main problem is, they're on their meds,
sure.
we're going to be good.
Right. And again, there's no surefire way,
right.
Obviously. There's no surefire solution. It's hard to still make that assessment in our county because our recovery court is fairly new and still growing. But when I was in Kankakee County, one of the things that seemed to work really well with mentally ill individuals was having a multitude of mental health agencies that were fully staffed and always had someone readily available day or night, brought them to court, brought them, took them to wherever they needed to take. It took something like that. And we did have an agency that was literally within steps from the courthouse where there was always, somebody there to advocate in those situations. And that seemed to work really well with a lot of the mentally ill clientele that we were dealing with. So, I guess the point I'm trying to make is it does take a lot of intervention. It takes a lot of supervision. We are definitely heading in that direction, I think, with our recovery court. We had our first graduation not long ago, and the program is working wonders for a lot of individuals with mental health issues. So
that is an issue. I mean, thank goodness that we've gotten started with recovery court, so we have another resource, but a lot of our mental health options are very slim in McLean County right now, and so we would be in a position where Sarge would be writing a report on someone who has mental health issues, and he says, I can't justifiably say that they should be released, because once they get released, we don't have readily available in the community to get their meds to them, and they stay on their meds when they're in custody. If they get out and they're not on their meds, then they're not going to show up, and they're going to go off the grid. So what you said, what you were talking about really piqued my interest.
It's something to see.
It's
yeah.
something we'll
yeah.
talk to inmate
yeah.
services about
yeah.
tomorrow and say,
yeah.
what if we could do kind of a partial, you're released on pretrial as long as you report to the jail and get your meds every day,
yeah.
If they could discuss that.
Yeah.
Because our mental health resources are pretty slim and there's a waiting list. So
yeah.
we would almost guarantee a lapse in services for some folks if we let them out. So.
Yeah,
because
we have come across that, and for me, it's I'm in this position where I have to thoroughly see if, okay, they already have some involvement on the outside in mental health treatment, because if they do, then we can work with this guy. But again, the agency itself, they have their list of guidelines, and if that's someone that's not involved, now they got to go through this whole process where they may have to wait 3 to 6 months before they see a psychiatrist. And, with him being in jail on his 10th criminal trespass, it's a good chance if we cut this guy loose, he's going to be back in here again, roaming the streets. And, and we're setting that guy up to fail. So we do have to make decisions based on that. Sir?
On the last pages of your handout here,
mm-hmm.
earlier in your discussion, you suggested you saved about $600,000
mm-hmm.
In 2010.
Mm-hmm.
But what I don't see, and maybe this is in here, I just missed it, are the administrative costs your salary and your partner's salary and part of your time, and what are the total cost benefits in rough figures? I mean, should we subtract a couple hundred thousand from this, or what?
Well, I don't make anything from this. I wish you did. So, but
I mean, but you have a salary, right? The county.
Yeah. And I mean, I can pay the standard salary, like that's consistent with the PO2 supervisory.
You don't have to. I'm not asking to tell me, Shelly. I'm just guessing. I'm just thinking. Okay, if you're saving $600K from not having these people in the system, you're also making an investment or spending some money in order to save that money. And I'm just asking you, well, how much money are you spending in order to save that $600K? Is it $150,000?
We translate into a year for a line officer and a supervisor. I mean, because it's about a two-person unit.
It would be contingent upon how much time the supervisor needed for, you know, to run the operation. It doesn't mean like Sarge is not only supervising, but hands-on. So you'd be talking probably $80,000 plus benefits, another 30%, so over $100,000.
So just over $100K in order to save $600K.
Well, but the $600,000, that's kind of a made up number, right? I mean, you're talking about days in jail.
Right. It's that kind of a figurative, you know. I mean, this is nothing that's like exactly to a T. As I had stated earlier, there could be a plus or minus ratio to this. You know, and what I was touching on earlier is the individuals I supervise, they may not have been in jail that long. You know, they may have been in there for a lot less time. But some of them also could have been housed out in another county at $80 to $100 a day. So, yeah, does this break it even? Does it give you the exact number? No.
Yeah.
But this is just more of a figurative type situation.
So maybe
not losing money on it.
Well, right. No, I'm not suggesting that at all. But I mean, so McLean County is no longer housing out of county.
They do still, but not to the level. I will say that I can't remember.
One year we spent over $700,000 housing out of county. We were so overcrowded.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when they really started. That's when pretrial just got started. So this was driven by jail overcrowding.
And you're still housing out of county?
We are, but in much smaller numbers. And
just a few over, but that's typical for this time of year.
Yeah.
And you haven't, obviously then McLean County hasn't shut down any parts of its jail or had empty blocks or
No. You guys have about, 300, a little over 300 capacity?
We have about 185
every day.
Really?
Yes.
McLean's, 220?
We're about 237, something like that. But, I mean, like I said, when I first started, the key number that we'd look at was total outhouse, and that used to be in, like, the mid-20s, the mid-30s. And, you know, now it's, like, 5, 7. I think now a bad month is like 10 to 15, but more often than not, you see like 5, so that you see the single digits. And am I the sole reason for that? No. I think it's a combination of things. We've made a lot of improvements as a system. There's been some positive systematic changes, you know, how we deal with, geographical limits on warrants and ordinance violations. You know, do we really need to spend hundreds of dollars finding a guy in Chicago that peed in public by ISU, you know, and who got a $100 ticket, you know? So just things like that. I mean, these are just some examples. But again, there's been some very positive systematic changes. How to move a case a little bit quicker. So I think all these things have driven the reduction of our overpopulation. Anybody else? Any other questions?
I want to say a figure, and I'd like two comments.
Okay.
Do you have about a 5-to-1 return on your investment, would you say, for this? It's costing you a little over $100K, and you're getting back, you say 600, maybe we'll say 500. Is it a 5-to-1 return on investment?
See, we're not the budget folks.
Yeah.
We're probably not the ones our director could probably tell you that.
Okay, what's your sense, Julie?
Well, I have no problems with their program at all. I really
I'm just thinking of the numbers here.
No, I know, and I mean, I really like the idea of supervision pre-trial, especially if we can get people services and monitor them. You know, but I know that Joe's people are very, his budget's been cut mostly because of problems with the state reimbursement uncertainty, and so to ask them to take on something else would be, in his, under his budget, impossible, I think he would say, nodding. So I don't, I mean, I guess when my questions about the $600,000 is more, can McLean County point to $600,000 out of their budget, that they're not spending that they had spent previously? I'm kind of doubting that because they still have to run a jail and they still, they're still housing people out of county. And so I don't, I think it's enough. And I totally get what you're saying as far as it's a number where you're saying this person, we did a report, and based on our report, the judge lowered the bond or allowed them out on recognizance, and otherwise they might have stayed in custody until the completion of their case,
right,
which was maybe 5 or 6 months down the road.
Yeah.
But it's also possible that if they hadn't been released on, let's say, August 1st, if they had stayed in custody, that their case might have been resolved 3 months earlier or, even sooner than that because they have a statutory right to a speedy trial. And so if they didn't want a continuance, their case would have had to have been resolved sooner than 6 months if they were in custody. They don't have that right if they're out of custody. Or there's more of an incentive to continue a case along if someone's out of custody as opposed to in custody. So there's a number of other factors that might go into the question of how long it would take to resolve a case. So I get, where that number is coming from. I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying.
Well, one of the points I want to make, and this isn't solely based on numbers, but I mean, the fact is that people do generally tend to plead guilty, or more likely to plead guilty, if they are housed in jail instead of getting the opportunity to get out and fight for their case. And so that is something that happens. And again, I don't have the exact numbers to a T, but there are also individuals that may be likely to plead guilty to an offense they may not have been guilty of, or exactly that particular offense. There was a percentage of cases that we supervised on pretrial services last year that did wind up found not guilty. Or the cases were just flat out dismissed because the state didn't have the evidence. So you have to also then ask the question, well, what was the likelihood that they may have pled guilty if they were in jail? So, if they stayed in jail. So those kind of things do come out in the forefront as well. But, as far as numbers, yeah, it's very arguable. I mean, a class 4 felony, a class 3 nonviolent felony, yeah, they may not be in jail as long, whereas, and we might have monitored them a lot longer than they would have been in jail. But I can say that for the class X, class 1, class 2s, if there's no pretrial program, these people are staying for the entirety of their case. And even some of these sex offense cases that wind up getting out, they get put on a GPS monitor with 24-hour home confinement. Without a pretrial program, they're going to be in there. And think about, if anyone has worked a sex offense case, you know how long those cases are pending. You're waiting on DNA evidence and things as such. You could be talking about a year. Actually, I have one case that's been pending almost 3 years. It's a sex case. And he's our first GPS. He's still on. But if there's no pretrial program, that kid's bond is $100,000, and he would have still been in jail. So.
Well, another thing that you can't, I don't know how you would arrive at a number, is if you release someone who is employed or employable, not only are they not costing you to house them in the jail, but they're contributing to the tax base. So that's a part of the big picture as well.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that, there's a lot of non-monetary value to pretrial services. That's where it's at. So I don't know that if you look at 100,000 versus 600,000, and it's much bigger.
And I know from my first time there, there was 1 year it was over 700,000 to ship and then there's a year after that that was like 570. I mean, there was 2-3 years in a row that was. So one of the things that maybe help us to quantify it some is I can see if the sheriff has numbers for that this year for how much they've, you know, spent out of. So I can try to follow up on that and get you guys an answer for that for our next meeting. But I think it's negligible compared to, I mean, we would get updates as they do here in Champaign County, honestly. But it's a combination of things. I mean, in my opinion, pretrial services is part of the overall philosophy that they took where this CJCC, there was the state's attorney and the sheriff and other stakeholders that literally would meet, if not on a weekly basis, very close to that, and figure out, all right, you know, what bonds are we asking for when we're getting close, things like that as well. And then you played a huge role in that. But I think, you know, we certainly see that here. There is a lot of communication between the jail, as we've learned, between the jail and the state attorney's office to try to adjust it as we go, you know, on a quicker basis. But I will say that as a prosecutor over there, I always appreciate it. In a case like that, if you had a sex offender or something like that on bond, that's the kind of case that would keep you up at night, except I'd get an email from Sergeant and say, we went by his house and he violated his curfew last night, or something like, or the GPS or whatever it be, and someone was out there watching, and we could then bring him right back into court, and the judge could address it immediately as opposed to, you know, having to wait for possibly an officer to go by and make an arrest. That's the only way you'd really know if they're out on bond without a pretrial service program. So I appreciated it.
I think the other thing that makes this work is the fact that the program does hold what's called, I mean, it has its teeth. If there are violations, and the violation is that to a degree that now there is a threat to public safety or there is a threat for this guy not showing back up, we're jumping on it right away, and we're gonna talk to the state, and we're going in front of a judge, and we're going to get a warrant for their arrest, and they're apprehended, like, right away. And so, again, this is one of those concepts where, you know, it's an unintended outcome. We're not trying to be punitive, but if an individual is given that one shot, they're given that opportunity, and in their mind, they're told, and they know in the beginning, that if you don't make this work, there's a good chance you're going to wind back up in here, they're more likely to succeed. And that's why things work for us, essentially. And you couple that with finding them the appropriate services. We even go step out of, you know, do some things that we technically don't have to do, but a lot of our individuals don't know the little basics on how to find a job, and how to find one online, how to prepare for a job interview, how to dress for an interview. So about every other week, in our local area, we find about 25, 30 job openings. And this is, we're talking about general employment, nothing that requires, you know, anything, and a college degree or anything. And, you know, we hand them the slip and provide those resources where they didn't even know. They had no idea because they didn't find it in their paper. You know, and where they lived, they hadn't heard anything about that. So we, you know, we are trying, and you know, we do GED referrals as well. So we try to keep, you know, this isn't just about buying the time until your case is resolved. You know, we are trying to contribute to making them productive citizens. So the ultimate goal is you don't have to ever come back in here again. You know, so and again, there is that aspect. Anybody else?
I actually have a question. Yeah. I don't know if maybe you guys know this, but how much do we spend on out-of-county placements a year?
Zero.
So for us, it's more about trying to operate in one facility versus two. Right. And so that's how we would. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, really, as far as I'm concerned, the bottom line question is there any way to get the numbers down low enough so that we could operate out of one facility that has two pods? Understanding that
yeah, I just wanted to make a distinction because I wasn't aware of any out-of-county costs for us. I thought we did pretty well there. So.
Yeah.
We would have to look for other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'd have to get our men down below.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there's, you know, I definitely didn't come down here to tell you. I'm here to talk about my program and why it works. I'm definitely not here to tell you. the number one constraint that a lot of counties are dealing with is, where are we going to have the staff to have a pre-trial program? Because that is a problem that's existing everywhere. You know, there are some other counties that are going with the philosophy of trying to do more with less, that kind of concept or whatever. And if they're seeing the overall outcomes, is having a pre-trial program maybe benefiting in that, then they're going to take a shot with that. But generally speaking, if there's a reason why counties can't formulate one, it's exactly that reason. There is still a budgetary issue. So I'm just fortunate that I am where I'm at. So.
Well, I just want to thank Sarge and Chris Bailey for working a long day in Bloomington and driving over here to help us out.
Yeah.
I told him a 20-minute presentation.
Did you really?
I did, but we did.
I called you out.
Yeah. I did. But I also want to appreciate. I want to say how much we appreciate all the stakeholders in the room, and thank you for coming out to listen to it as well.
You guys have been great. The questions were excellent.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I almost used this wall, at least two.
Thank you so much.
Great. Well, let's move on to item 7 on our agenda, review of the task force purpose. I think we had a little bit of confusion last time about everybody was concerned about what exactly you're supposed to do here. This is from the founding document. Now, of course, you guys are going to be doing a report, the suggestions and information, so that can be fairly narrow, that can be fairly broad, but as we go forward, keep in mind that the county board wants some guidance in looking at what is going on, what the county is paying for in these various areas that we're looking at every month, and like tonight, and other things that you're looking at and hopefully have experience in, suggestions on how we can improve things, suggestions for the county, directions that we can go. And you guys are here because you know better than us what those may be and what could be some productive avenues for us to go down, some changes to make. And I think that rolls into, are there any questions or comments on Section 7? I think that rolls into 8, our discussion of next steps. Is Busey still here? We have next month scheduled, right, Ms. Busey?
You're scheduled every month through October.
Okay, so next month we're going over state's attorney programs in August?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant where your meeting's scheduled.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That we've set future agendas.
Okay. So we'd certainly like input from you guys on who you would like to talk with about current services. We've, of course, heard from the sheriff's operations. We've heard what McLean County is doing. But anything you guys want to look at, we would like to work to bring those people in if they would be willing to. Sheila.
I know that we had requested to visit the satellite jail. So maybe that needs to be scheduled as well.
Did
at your last meeting, I think you talked about the fact that you really didn't want to do that in connection with the meeting because of today, right?
Yeah.
But maybe
and
not.
You are all, I mean, the sheriff will be happy to schedule tours if you want to individually set them up if you would like them. If you want to go through as a group, then you probably need to identify another time that we can schedule with the sheriff for you to go through as a group.
Actually, I think that's great if we can schedule on our own.
Yeah.
I think that's not a problem with the sheriff.
Excellent.
Okay.
Should we?
Right.
What was that, Pius? Your microphone's not actually working.
You'll avoid the ONA problem if you need a meeting.
So no more than
a favorite thing. Julian, you had a question or comment?
I was just going to suggest that it might be, even if it's not a problem, it might be convenient if there's a group of us that could go at one time rather than just have 9 people making individual schedule?
I think it's up to you. I think the sheriff is willing to do it either way. So it's up to you. If you're going to do it, go as a group, then we probably need to publish the fact that you're going to do that.
Yeah.
Which is not a problem.
Well, I mean, we can decide, I guess. I'm suggesting that it might be convenient and also in some ways useful. Publish it, and we can actually talk to each other as we're going through it. It's another way to get some work done.
Well, what's everybody want to do?
I found it helpful to hear other people's questions in the jail. I think it's efficient. I'm an efficiency. I don't want to get in any problems with the Open Meeting Act, but it sounds like we can address that, you said, by just publishing.
Yeah,
so it might be that we selected a couple dates, and then if somebody can't make either one, then or select one, and then if somebody can't make it,
so should we maybe look for a Monday to see if the sheriff can host us?
If you pick a date, you'll probably be able to do the tour.
Yeah, I think.
If you pick a date and time.
Did we have the discussion? Mondays are generally best for people, even if they're not this Monday.
I believe that's what.
The first Monday? So, yeah. Okay. So, we will. How about.
Try for July 16th?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. 2 weeks from today.
Okay.
Ought to be.
And at what time? At 6?
Is 6 good for everybody? Would it be ice? Is 6 was fine with the sheriff's department, right?
Yes, they'll work around it.
5:30 or? 5:30, 6 on the 16th. Is that good for everybody? No?
I mean, I'm out of town, so. I mean,
any other no's? So, sounds like most everybody can do 6 p.m. on the 16th.
So, you'll meet, convene at the lobby of the satellite dish.
Yeah. Okay. So, any other comments on that, Julian?
If we're looking toward our future agenda, I was about to ask Julia a bunch of questions, but she left, so maybe we can schedule, if we need to. I think it would be useful for us to talk to her about what
the state's
we in
attorney.
Fact do. So.
And we've, have we?
Okay. I mean, we may or may not want to do that now, but.
Yeah.
We probably want to do it sometime.
I'd like to think about my set of questions before.
Yeah.
I have a suggestion because, and it's only this, here's my concern, that there's so much to know and so little time. So for us to think about, to identify who else we want to get formal presentations from or develop other information gathering methods. And then it may be that we'll have to have, we've already talked about getting more feedback regarding substance abuse, not just the drug court, but also inpatient-outpatient treatment. So for somebody to identify who would be, key presenters, we talked about the state's attorney because of the diversion program. I'd like to hear personally from Joe Gordon, who I know is here, but we give you notice, Joe. Because probation, again, can be, just to get better educated about what's happening right now and perhaps unrealized potential and the challenges you're facing. We already heard about the funding, but just to make sure that we're educated. What we're trying to do, as I understand it, is we're trying to get educated about what's happening and where there might be gaps in services, what are the problems, and how that can make the system work better for everybody. So I could see us, literally, I thought today was so informative. I just thought this was so helpful. So if we start figuring out, so I'm not sure we have to identify all today in terms of who's
going
to be here in August, but we need to funnel our suggestions of who else we need to hear from. We've mentioned probation, we've mentioned substance abuse, mentioned state's attorney. I mean, there are a lot of other key stakeholders on issues, but in terms of what are kind of the programs or sanctioning options currently available. So if you can talk about what other informational needs do you think you have, I think that would help us.
So
I guess what I'm saying is we may have to have somebody come in and we say for 45 minutes we're going to learn about this. For the next 45 minutes we're going to learn about this, because otherwise we may be meeting until next June just getting the base information.
One thought that I have about this is that it is, we do have to deal with what programmatic options exist in this community. It's important for us to know and then try to identify other things. So there's that whole issue, but I guess what I also feel a need to get a handle on, and maybe other people already have this, I'd like to have some more concrete sense of how we are currently operating here. So, for example, I would have been interested in having you talking about, well, here's what we do. I'm not thinking now about any specific thing. I'm thinking it would be useful for us to understand what your view is of just how the process works, how people are processed through it, what the options are, however terrific you think it is, I'm going to imagine that you could also imagine ways, put aside money for a minute and just think about what you see yourself as gaps in that system or things that could happen that might move it along without being absolutely limited by what's just practical because I'm afraid nobody will be able to pay for it. Just so we could have some sense of what your experience is telling you about operating this system. So that's sort of what I was hoping we could spend some time doing. That's agreeable to you and to everybody else.
Sometime tonight or in the future?
I think probably in the future. Unless, I don't know how much time you want to spend now doing that.
You know, I think I prefer to formulate some questions and think carefully about some of these ideas so that I'm prepared to ask a couple of questions as opposed to calling you back again and again.
Well, also, I know we've been talked, and I apologize if you addressed this when I left the room, but we had talked about actually seeing the satellite jail as well. And I think...
Did
we talk about it? All right, okay, because I think that perhaps that would... We did that before that would help us answer
this.
It's my birthday, so we're very well supposed to be... I'd be there anyway, probably.
You're going to be 35?
I
would suggest... Are you going to be in the jail, or...
I said I'd end up there anyway, so this just saves me a trip.
Can I suggest that if you're interested in considering things that are lacking, that one of the things I would suggest on the adult side is jobs programs. I think it would be interesting to explore what jobs programs we have in the community. From my perspective, they seem to come and go, depending on grant funding. Carpooling sometimes has things, sometimes there are summer things. But from my perspective,
I mean, to me, it would just be useful to have you talk us through. Here's what happens. Somebody gets arrested. Here's what happens then. Here's how long this takes. Here's what we could offer. Here's what we do or don't do.
I could tell you that in about 10 minutes right now. Somebody gets arrested today. Tomorrow morning, you'll get a police report. A complete police report. Which is different from a lot of times. Every day at 1:30, we have arraignment court. So everybody who's arrested today is going to be in court tomorrow at 1:30 to have their bond set and their charges read to them and their public.
doctor, we'll call the public defender and say, have you discussed this with your client? Or we'll agree to recognizance and let them out if they're staying in jail for a few days or a week or not. There are, I can read this list to you, let's see. Home invasion, aggravated criminal sexual assault, armed violence, burglary, unlawful use of a weapon, unlawful use of a weapon, possession of a stolen vehicle, unlawful use of a weapon, burglary. That's just one page. There's nobody here. I'm not saying that there aren't people, but those are the people I have to catch and say, oh, hey, here's a guy on a $1,500 bond. I need to talk to, he's still in custody on two ordinance violation cases. So I have to call the city and say, hey, you guys really want this guy sitting in jail? He's only been in since the 29th. So it's my job to stay on top of these people.
I know McLean County has their criminal justice coordinating council, but several years ago, and specifically back in 2005, when my boss, Judge Giovannis, took over, we were bumping up against the maximum capacity of the jail. And so he started to have meetings where all of the people in the criminal justice system sat around and talked about the different ideas about how to reduce the numbers. And as Julia just said, a lot of it is just based on communication between the different offices. The sheriff talking to the state's attorney, talking to the public defender, working through these issues. And over time, we've been able to, as you can tell from the population, it's been considerably less. And that's not because crime is going down. That's because people are trying to move these cases through the system. So I think that things are definitely, the communication network is there and is used.
So are you if we're having this conversation now, or maybe we can have more later, but do I understand that what you, I don't want to speak for you, but what I might conclude is that you think that you're already doing about what you could do to move the cases along and keep as many people who don't need to be jailed out of jail right now?
Yes. I think we're doing everything we can to meet that goal, but that does not, you know, that does not resolve the facilities issue that this county faces.
It's just speaking about that issue of that. I mean,
I'm
wanting to get your sense.
And I'm not saying that there are people that we miss, but I'm saying that we do everything we possibly can to pay attention to that issue and to make sure that the right people are in custody.
And just one interesting statistic, you heard tonight that McLean County has 237 in custody. Champaign County has 185. Champaign County's population is 15% larger than McLean County's.
It must be that we have nicer people here. We're a better class of criminal.
Yeah.
Smart criminal.
And I don't want to sit here and compare them to us.
No, I was not concerned about the comparison. I'm just actually trying to understand the way you understand it, mm-hmm. that you feel that. I think you said yes. Do you feel that you're doing? It's work. You think the system's working well with respect to keeping the numbers of people out of jail who don't need to be in jail. I guess that would be.
But there are people, like I said, there's a guy here who we agreed on a recognizance bond, but he's got two city ordinance warrants, which are city tickets from Urbana. And they have, the city of Urbana has to address that. And I don't know whether they even know he's sitting in our jail. That's a whole separate. So I need to call the city attorney's office tomorrow and say, hey, you guys have a guy in jail who, you know, is sitting there on city tickets. So I'm not, I'm not saying that there aren't people who I say, oh, what is this person doing in there? You know, but.
But you have a system to address it, is what you're saying. Right. That's kind of what I'm after.
Yes.
Thanks.
Well, Julia, Roger, Joe, do you guys have anything else you'd like to add to the presentation tonight? And does anybody here have any questions specifically on pretrial services that you'd like to ask of our guests while they're here? Okay. Is anybody... Mark.
Continuing
on next steps. So walking back, we'll have an October meeting where we need to finalize a report that's going to go to the county board. So that leaves us September and August for meetings.
That's the current operating authority. We have been talking, the county board would have to ratify it, but with the needs assessments, none of them, they are all going to want to be talking to this task force, and we are not expecting any of the four RFPs that are going to be looked at to be done by the time that this committee is supposed to be wrapping up. So we've been talking about possibly extending the committee if you guys would be willing to do that. It hasn't come before the county board yet. The county board may or may not want to do that. But it would make some sense to keep this going at least another month. So that's something to think about if you guys are willing to keep this up.
When is that consultant issue going to be decided?
It's going to be next Tuesday. That's the 10th. Right, Pius?
That will happen when the county board decides to make it happen.
True.
Schedules mean nothing.
Yeah. But the meeting, what Pius is saying, the meeting, so
the meeting to discuss
on June 26th, we had the presentations. The county board will look on the 10th at, not the 10th?
That meeting, the 10th from the council.
What?
Well, you haven't read the email today,
Mike. I apparently have not seen my email today.
So the next scheduled meeting is the regular county board meeting, which, maybe count
yeah.
too.
So like Pius said, when the county board feels like it, it will either take this up or not take this up. And at some point in the future, if there are 14 votes, the county may select one of the four to do a needs assessment for the county.
Actually, it's just a majority. Majority of whoever's going to get
yes.
votes. I will add about the deadline of October. That was a deadline I put in there because I felt it would be no good to give it to the county board in November when it's their last meeting, and they'll just stick it on the shelf and everybody goes home. Some people will never return, some will. This way, they get it in October, they can talk about it, and maybe in November, do something. If the next county board wants to extend this committee, they can do that. This county board cannot do that. We only can take things to the end of the two-year period, which ends at the end of November. So there's a little bit of wibble logic there.
Michael, can we throw out another topic that might be of interest?
Yes.
Domestic violence counseling is another one that would be interesting to look at to see what we have and what we're lacking. We used to have a lot of more private agencies in the county that closed due to funding issues. And I know Joe's people are always struggling with finding resources for people, both on the offender side and the victim side.
Okay.
So, Mike, if I may, then I guess walking back from an unknown deadline, coming at it from the other direction going forward, so we would use August to kind of get our input from court services and the state's attorney, and then I guess September start looking at the community resources and those questions in terms of what's available, be it employment, domestic violence, housing, substance abuse. And we have Sheila here. She shared previously. And then from there, depending on what where our charge stands, start identifying gaps and then a report. I just kind of want to map this out a little bit. And at one point, we also had, I think it was Sheila that suggested at some point we should start building a continuum of services. We've had, discussion with the sheriff about what occurs within the jail during incarceration. We've had some discussion about what's available post-conviction, some discussion tonight about pre-trial, and start mapping those services out.
and get those on a continual.
Yeah, and see where the gaps are. I know that's kind of one of the ways we will write the report, is to see where the gaps are and potential for improvements with community-based services. I think we do the same with what's available in the jail and court services and state's attorney's office.
So if we had, question Pius, because it's Pius's schedule or whatever, your perspective. If this group had a preliminary report and then maybe in November, December had a more finalized report, it would carry over full time frames. Because I don't know if we could do everything before the October, but maybe we could get some preliminary thoughts down on paper, and hopefully the county board will want more detail about our thoughts, and we'll be able to talk with the consultants and so on and continue our work.
I cannot speak for the county board, but I'm sure they'll be happy to get anything from you. If they get something a little bit later, they'll still be happy. It's sort of like you're doing a mini thesis, which most of you probably have done, except one or two, and you probably enjoyed it as much then as you might enjoy doing this now. So it's obviously there might be some aspects, like you said, you can start mapping out your continuum right now, and at least get the bullets down, and hopefully something will come together. You also could have additional meetings too.
Yeah.
You're not, you don't have to meet just once a month, meet twice a month.
And the this committee is not set to disband the first Monday of October. It's just quote October, right, Pius?
Correct. Well, I think that the committee disbands at the end of November, so you can still meet in November.
Well, I wonder, maybe Julian, you know this, or maybe Lynn, you know this, but it seems to me that there's probably a scholar or a set of scholars who've examined these questions and who have evidence in support of a set of comprehensive recommendations. Is that true?
You want to?
Oh, I was going to say it was quite a few. I mean,
I haven't looked into the literature. I don't know if anybody's actually delved into the literature. I don't know what the various positions are, or kinds of lines of thinking or lines of intervention. I'm sure some of them are based on cost benefit analyses. Others are based on a larger set of values. Seems like it would be helpful to tap into that stuff as well. Go ahead.
Well, one thing I was going to say, and this is actually, I think we should look at this in positive terms. We face a challenge, but it's a welcome challenge. As I had mentioned, if I could create the universe, we would have a broad-based group. We would already have something, a community corrections board or whatever you want to call it, criminal justice coordinating council that includes the key stakeholders and members of the public. And we don't have that right now. So we have a task force that's looking at alternatives to incarceration and other related issues such as reentry. And then we have a committee that is very appropriately looking at facility issues, and we observed and witnessed the gravity of the problems. And then third, we have a consultant coming in. So the question is, how can we make this work? So that all the work products that are produced by the different groups are of high quality, so it's integrated, and most appropriately, so that there is harmony. And when I say harmony, that doesn't mean that everybody has the same opinion, but that people start to trust each other, that we understand that we all have the common objective of making things work better. And I think right now we aren't there yet. Because it's kind of it's a natural process, but it is harder because we aren't all at the same table right now. And I've worked at where you have everybody at the same table. And I know somebody's not here right now, maybe they are and I don't know them. I don't see anybody from defense, for example, and that makes it difficult. So one of the thoughts I had, and that's why I raised some questions about the consultant, because the consultant, the RFP, we talked about this a bit last meeting, the RFP talks about that person serving, actually doing several different kinds of assessments. There's the facility assessment, but there's also looking at what I call the alternative issue. I don't like that. And how do we put this together? Normally I'd have to say, you start with, are there people in jail who don't need to be there? Are there better ways of you know, of other options that should be considered? We heard about one today. And then, in light of what is found, what do we do with our very real facility problem? How we answer that latter question, it seems to me, is affected by the first question, which gets me to the consultant. What everybody needs is somebody who can crunch the numbers and use these risk assessment tools that were just mentioned. And it's got to be the right tools. There are bad risk assessment instruments out there. But for example, this group decides that a day reporting center is a really good option because somebody can go in and there can be, you know, the substance abuse treatment, so on and so forth. Or at least needs to be explored. You need somebody who looks for the risk assessment tool and says, if you do that, that's going to have this impact on the jail and there's going to be these cost repercussions, et cetera. I don't think we have that empirical expertise here. We need a consultant who can do that. And that's why the selection of the consultant is it's important, it's actually very complicated. And I think Julian really, and I don't know if this is a good segue, and it's not who you felt was better, not getting into that, but your sense of where we are, because my general sense is I need more information about those consultants before I feel a decision could be made that the board would really feel comfortable with. So I don't know, we haven't talked about this, so I don't know. You heard the presentations. If you today had to make a decision, not what would it be, but is there more information that needs to be collected?
It's related to Bill's question about, yeah. And there's a tremendous amount of information that you know that there's literatures, and a lot of literature. And I don't think the alternatives in the abstract are obscure at all. I think they're what we could sit down and we could, just based on collective thinking, given and a very little bit of research, you can talk about all the things that could fill in this system. The problem to me is that all of that's in the abstract. None of it makes sense except in the concrete and the particular county and the particular possibilities that exist in the real world in which we're operating. So, for example, if I were a judge, I could know a fair number of possible things that I could do with a particular accused person or a convicted person. I would have a number of options that exist in the world in general. But I will be completely limited by what is available in this community. I cannot assign somebody to a program that I think is wonderful unless that program exists. So, in some sense, what we have to do is figure out how to combine all the possible ideas there are and all our creativity with how you might get those with the real world of what's possible in this community. Now, sometimes you don't know what's possible. So, for example, this is one thing that's crossed my mind. You know, we have in this county, I don't know how many counties have it, we have a 708 board that deals with mental health services, and they have a source of funds. And they don't make up what mental health services should happen. What they do is send out RFPs and invite proposals, and the local community people who are competent in those areas then suggest things to be done. And so what you're doing is you're working with the real world. It seems to me that one of the things that the criminal justice system in Champaign County could think about establishing would be some similar. I mean, it may be that politically, all we can talk about is money for bricks and mortar. I have no idea what the politics of that will turn out to be. But it may be that there is a changing view of criminal justice and its relationship to other systems, and that the county might be willing to take some sort of a step toward establishing, I don't know what to call it, but some sort of a systems analytic team of people that would include a funding stream in which they could ask for proposals. So I think it's far better to ask for proposals from local people than it is to imagine something that we could think of, but nobody wants to do. So that's sort of where I would, I'm hoping we could head somewhere in that direction.
Why? Well,
I'm willing to hear that you do it.
I
have no idea.
And Mark can help me with this. On the juvenile side, when the county board decided to build the detention center, board members also decided to set aside a portion of those funds for delinquency prevention programs. And the mental health board supplements those funds as well. And we, Joe and I, Peter Tracy from the mental health board, get together, and every year we determine how those funds are going to be spent. What programs are we going to be bringing to the community? And one of those programs that we found after we determined there was a need was parenting with love and limits. And so we decided, we saw a need, a hole, with regards to counseling for young people who are in the criminal justice system and their families. In other words, there was a lot of counseling out there for the kid, but nothing for the parent. And so Peter Tracy went to a conference, and we saw a presentation that we thought would address that need. And we used those course and sales tax funds and mental health board funding to pay for that program. I think something similar could be done if we were to do construction with regards to an adult.
And if I can go back to what Bill was saying earlier, we hope that you are using your experiences to review the literature, look at reports, use your experience and credentials to find some solutions that are more accessible to you than the county board, independently of these meetings. We just don't have the time to bring in too many people before you to decide, is this not working? A lot of that's the kind of thing we want you to put that in there, because to the best of my knowledge, there are no criminologists or sociologists on the county board. And so we are depending on you and your expertise, your knowledge, and your professional experience in various areas of criminal justice to help show us what is going on outside of Champaign County. We're trying to help educate you on what is going on in Champaign County, but you're going to have to, basically independent of these meetings, work on what you can bring to the table to show us that maybe other municipalities, jurisdictions are doing well, what the literature might say works. These guys in the back work with this stuff, but a lot of this is just going to be new to the county board. Do we have we exhausted next steps, or is there anybody else have something to weigh in? I think the schedule Mark was talking about probably makes the most sense, that next month, depending on if people can make it and if they're willing to try to talk some more with the state's attorney and or court services, probation if they're willing to come in, some things like that, and then...
Can we have somebody from defense? Can we have a public defender or a defense attorney from town come in and share some perspectives as well?
Well, we can, depending if the court system is willing, the public defender is somebody who could be asked to appear as well. Scott has served as a defense attorney, right?
Yes, sir.
even though he's in the state's attorney's office now.
not like Randy.
I'm certain that if they asked Mr. Rosenbaum to appear at a certain date and time, I'm pretty positive.
So well, it would be seems to me interesting to ask from defense side what they think about the same things I asked Julia, for example.
I agree.
because they may have another perspective. They may be agree completely with what you said, or they may have other thoughts, but it will help us to understand the system better if we're hearing that. So I hope that we could.
The comment I was making about next steps, and I understand it's, I get the sense it's maybe a charged question, and I don't mean it to be, but I do know that in the history of government, I'm not talking about this county, you can hire consultants and you get a report and it really doesn't help. And what I'm saying is there were a couple of good presentations, and I'm not going to identify the vendors, but I couldn't possibly, and I live and breathe this stuff, I couldn't possibly make a decision without doing further investigation. And all I'm saying is if the right consultant, I can't even say if either of those two, it might be there's not one that can meet this county's needs. So there was a lot of talk about that consultant working with both the jail planning committee and the task force, which of course is right, because ultimately we're going to all have to work together. And so when we talk about next steps, I would hate to see that decision be based just on the presentations without further investigation, and I don't have a sense of what's happening to make sure, in terms of identifying the consultant. So that's just, I guess, what I'd have to say is a question.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I was at the presentations and I heard them, and I have my own, I could rank order them myself. I'm not doing that, but your sense that it's difficult to figure out how the county board would make an intelligent decision about it, I will say that that's my feeling as well, if I'm expressing that correctly. But then again, that's, I don't know where the county board is and what they're thinking and what they intend to get from it and so on. So, and that seems a little bit outside of our, we don't have any, do we have anything to say about that? I don't think they want to know what we think about those consultants, do they?
I would say that the more public input,
participation, yeah. Say what you want.
Yeah, the more input that the county can get, the better educated decision the county board will make. I don't have a sense that there necessarily is an overwhelming pick or that it's a done deal. I think that the fact this was postponed indicates that a lot of the county board is struggling with what to do on this issue. And so I think if anybody has opinions on what we should be looking for in needs assessment, or for those of you who are familiar with the presentations, if you have any opinions, yeah, please say them in public participation, or if you have an opinion on it, let the county board know. Pies.
Through the whole meeting, the council committee, we didn't have much else to meet for. It also gives people more time. Those people were not at the meeting. Look, watch Channel 5, that's the tape, and listen to just the audio, try to get the super guests. So not going to the meeting, but live, and try to make a decision. That's not a message of the county board making an intelligent decision. I have no comment.
Well, we know that. We know that always happens, so we don't need to bring that up.
In the For What It's Worth department, I appreciate that there are board members sitting here listening. I think it would be helpful if more county board members knew what was going on in the criminal justice system and the process.
Overabundance of extra time, but if an individual
had the interest in doing that. I don't want to look like I'm, because I'm not representing the task force, but I just, I'm like a sponge. I want to know more. So even if we can't, as a group, it may be that one or two of us, well, we have to deal with the OMIs, I don't know, but we can reach out to get educated by different, not just the people here, but by others as well. So we can kind of think about this, but we've got a lot to learn, so we can in turn, you know, help to inform.
Well, and a lot of these sessions that we're doing, we've tried to do some similar things with the county board, but a lot of, especially tonight, but even a lot of last month, and if we get some stakeholders in next month, even that information, some of that's going to be new to the county board. So just keep that in mind when you're doing these reports. Pius, did you have something?
You know, if you go to the 130 arraignment and you see another member of this group here, don't worry about it, you know?
Yeah.
Because you're there independently. You're not going to talk about it there, so don't worry about that.
Okay. Anything else on next steps? Is there any other business?
Have one update I thought my group would want to know. It's kind of interesting that this process does this, but last week we trained, we partnered actually with the Sheriff's Department and the Mental Health Board and trained, I know, three of our staff on MRT, moral recognition therapy, evidence-based practice for use in the jail, like I talked about last time, so right here, including those three that are our staff, the two mental health professionals at the jail were trained, the number of the officers, of the deputies were trained, and so I just wanted to give you an update on that, and it looks like those groups will be starting up, so they'll be inside the jail and then also outside the jail, so people will be able to move from one to the other. Evidence-based practice, I know Julia and I have talked about that. The more we have evidence-based practices that have a beginning and an end, the better for us. They've been very successful, and so we're moving in that direction.
Great.
So I have to thank, you know, Champaign County Mental Health Board for their support and the sheriff for his willingness to schedule the deputies and the staff there and make it happen, because it's a 4-day training, so it's pretty intense.
Okay. Any other business? Our next meeting date is Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. However, we also have our visit to the satellite jail, which is going to be 2 weeks from tonight, the 16th, at 6 p.m. at the lobby of the satellite jail. Thank you, everybody, for your time and your comments tonight. We are now adjourned.
So this is, I am not actually, I'm not.